Today I would like to share some of my experience in handling various types of missing data problem in various statistical genetics issues which I have come across. And I'm going to talk about three quite different areas. And so my advanced apology, if it sounds a little scattered all over the place, but hopefully I'll be able to convey like what are some of the special issues which arises in the context of handling missing data in genetic studies. So the first study I'm going to talk about is skin cohort analysis. This analysis was first introduced in the context of this study, what is now known as the Washington Ashkenazi study. About 5,000 Ashkenazi Jewish men and women volunteers living in the Washington DC area participated in this study, who provided blood samples which were then used to genotype for three specific founder mutation in these two gene, high risk and gene for breast cancer and ovarian cancer, for founder mutations for this population. And then through questionnaire, the probands also, we should call this thing, people who participate as the probands, also provided a detailed history of various cancers among the relatives of the proband, including age at onset information. And they also had provided information on personal history of cancer. So it's a little bit like the formulation of what Scott was mentioning. But the one difference is that here the relatives themselves are not contacted and they are never genotyped. So you're missing the covariate information on the relatives. So anyway, one of the interesting features of the original analysis which was used to analyze the data was that so the relatives were treated as if they are like a retrospective cohort who are being followed from the birth until the incidence of these cancers or censoring. But the relatives themselves are not genotyped. So, but the proband, that is the one family member in the relatives, they are genotyped. So that kind of provides some indirect information on the genotypes of the relatives. So it's like it gives a probabilistic information. So it's kind of and they show that you can link the relatives' phenotype information to the proband's genotype information to estimate risk of disease from these mutations. And that this kind of indirect way of estimating things was called the kin cohort estimation. And although the proband's disease history information was available just to survey, this study was based on volunteers. And so they are very worried about a lot of volunteer bias, in particular survival bias of the cases. So they didn't want to use the disease status information from the proband. And anyway, this study got a lot of attention at that time because this study estimated the lifetime risk of breast cancer among the carriers of BRCA1 and 2 mutations to be about 56%, which was much lower than what was previously thought. Like previous study reported, like it almost the risk are as high as like 90%, 100%. So it was like almost certain that if you have these mutations, you'll have breast cancer. But this study showed there's still a lot of uncertainty left. So here are some notations. So what are the observed data? The observed data are the phenotypes of the relatives. That means the IH proband is reporting the disease status of, say, NI relatives. And this could be very general. It could be a binary disease status or a survival type, age at onset, censoring type of phenotype. And we also know the genotype of the proband. That means the subject was interviewed. Now, what is unobserved here is the genotype of the relatives, because the relatives were never contacted. So the vector of that would be called I'll call GR. And so that's the missing part. The likelihood approach for analyzing this kind of data was first kind of given in this paper. So the idea is to link the phenotype information from the relatives to the genotype of the proband. So we look at the joint probability of the disease history in the relatives given the genotype of the proband. That's where we start. And then we do the standard approach. So we condition on the unobserved genotype status of the relatives, because that's not observed. So we uncondition with respect to those all possible genotype combination of those relatives. And this represents the joint genotype probabilities among family members given the genotype of the proband. Now, at this point, one further makes this assumption that it's a very typical assumption that it's a conditional independence assumption, that is, given the set of genotypes, the phenotypes are independent, which is also same as the assumption is that there is no residual familial aggregation. That means all the familial aggregation of the disease can be explained by the gene we are studying. And so we make the assumption, then the joint probability can be written as the product of the marginal probabilities. And that's the, that is defined in terms of penetrance model. That means we have a, we are really interested in estimating the risk of the disease given the set of our genes. And there are certain, so that's a marginal parameter, and there are certain parameters involved here. And it could be a non-parametric model also, a pretty non-parametric here. But main thing is notice that we are interested in estimating these parameters involving these probabilities. And then we have the joint distribution of the genotype of the relatives given the genotype of the proband that's specified by the Mendelian distribution, the Mendelian law as a function of the allele frequency. Now the problem with this likelihood is that the inference on these parameters of the marginal model is actually sensitive to this conditional independence assumption. And this is kind of a departure from the standard property known of the maximum likelihood when there is no missing data. Notice that if this sum was not there, that means there was no missing data, we know that a maximum likelihood, assuming the conditional independence, would still give a consistent estimate of the marginal parameters. It just will have to fix the variance. But when you are mixing these probabilities, the conditional probabilities, over this, with respect to this multivariate distribution of the genotypes, and we are using the known correlation structure among the genotypes, that nice robustness property of the maximum likelihood does not hold anymore. But how, fortunately, there is an alternative approach which can give back some of the robustness approach. So the idea is that suppose this is a proband who is reporting the disease status of three of the relatives. So what we are going to do is that we are going to break up this whole family into three families where each family consists of as a pair of individuals. Where the pairs consist of the proband and one relative. And I'm going to treat these pairs as if like they're completely independent families. That means I'm going to ignore the correlation both on the phenotype as well as the genotype. And if we do that, so if I treat each family as an independent family, then we can, within a family, we can look at the probability of the disease status of that individual relative given the genotype of the proband. That's the likelihood for that pair. And then I'm going to treat those pairs as all independent. And that's the product over the proband. And this probability again can be computed by first conditioning on the genotype status of that individual relative because all the computation is with respect to one relative at a time. And then sum it over the possible genotypes. And this is the probability of the genotype status of that particular relative given the genotype of the proband. And these probabilities again depend on the penetrance parameter which you are trying to estimate. So notice the main difference of the previous likelihood is that notice the sum here has been taken inside and the product is outside, So here the sum was outside and the product is inside, and notice that here although we are assuming a conditional independence in the phenotype, that means that given the phenotypes are independent. That's the model we are using, but we are making use of the known correlation structure in the genotypes. Because that's specified by the Mendelian distribution. But in this model, because the product has been taken outside, we are kind of ignoring the correlation both in the phenotypes given the genotypes, but as well as we are ignoring the correlation, the known correlation structure in the genotypes. And it's like, and that gives the robustness back, and you can show that this gives the valid estimating equations, irrespective of what kind of residual correlation is there. So it's like kind of ignoring both correlation in the outcomes and the covariates, you can get the robustness back. And there's some other advantage because computation is simple because we are looking at only one relative at a time. So this number of sums, the number of terms over which you're going to take the sum is much smaller. If you have a lot of relatives, then if you want to do the full multivariate approach, you'll have to consider all possible genotype combinations. But here you are looking at one relative at a time, so it's much simpler. And we have observed that, of course, if the conditional independence assumption is valid, then the full maximum likelihood would be the most efficient. But we have found that usually the loss of efficiency is pretty modest as long as the family size is not pretty very big. So the main observation here is the known robustness property of maximum likelihood under this conditional independence assumption for analysis of clustered data may not hold when you have missing data in covariates. And the covariates may be correlated within the clusters. But robust inference may be still possible using this kind of composite likelihood approach, or even there may be other alternative estimating equation methods. So I'm going to move on to the next topic, which is the haplotype-based association analysis. And this is work mostly done by Jinbo Chen, who is also here, and she will talk about another topic tomorrow. So I'll start with a few terminologies. Haplotypes. It is basically a set of alleles on the same on one chromosome of a human being. So this is an example. Suppose these two lines represent two chromosomes in a pair of chromosomes, the parental and maternal chromosome in a subject. And we are looking at two locus within the chromosome. And then in the first chromosome, this subject carries the combination of alleles, say, Cap A and Cap B. And that defines one haplotype. And then the second chromosome, it carries the combination of alleles small A and small B. That defines the other haplotype. And the pair of haplotypes together is called diplotype. And those who are familiar with the genetic epidemiology will know that there has been a lot of excitement about this called haplotype-based association analysis, which says basically the study of the association of the risk of the disease with haplotypes instead of looking at individual SNPs. And the idea is that if you are trying to study the association of a disease within a genomic region and within which you may have allelic variation at multiple locus, then a powerful approach for studying the association may be to look at the combination of the SNPs together instead of looking at it individually. And I'll not go into the arguments. There are a lot of debates about whether actually it will be more powerful or not, but there are a lot of haplotype analysis going on. So the statistical challenge here is that the kind of data we have is what is called locus-specific genotype data. We actually are not given haplotype. So we are given that at this first locus, this person is heterozygous. And in the second locus, it's also heterozygous, just for example. I'm going back to the same example. But from that data, which is the locus-specific genotype data, I cannot tell with certainty whether the Cap A, Cap B chromosome, the alleles, comes in the same chromosome or it comes in the opposite chromosome. So that information is not given. We are only given this information. And that phenomena is called phase ambiguity. And so you can see that it's clearly a missing data problem. So the one special thing is that about this problem is that there are some identifiability issues, because certain type of diplotypes, like for example this pair of diplotypes, are never directly observed, because they come with always this genotype, and whenever you observe this genotype, both this and this is possible. So you'll never observe one subject who you can for certainty that this was the diplotype for that subject. So clearly, if you cannot observe certain categories of your exposure directly, then you cannot estimate parameters related to those categories without making further assumptions. And so one way to resolving some of those identifiability issues to bring in this assumption of, called Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, which is basically an assumption, it is basically the follows from random mating of asserted the chromosomes, which is like an independent assumption. That means we assume the probability of a pair of haplotypes, the ordered haplotypes, is given by the product of the probabilities, the individual haplotypes. And this is the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium assumption. So once you do that, one of the first thing we do in a haplotype-based analysis or the genetic analysis is try to estimate the haplotype frequencies. And you may want to do that because estimation of haplotype frequency is useful to understand the population genetics of a particular genomic region, or it is also useful to do actually construct tests of association. And again, since if we could observe directly the pair of haplotypes a subject carries, this would be just a standard counting algorithm. But since we cannot observe it, this can be solved. The problem can be solved by a missing data technique, and which is EM algorithm. And the idea is that it is also a counting algorithm. So the estimate of the RS haplotype. So if we could observe all the haplotypes, then this would be just a proportion. So in the numerator, you have a certain count and divided by the total number of units. And note that here the unit is not subject, it's the chromosome. So if there is n subject, there will be 2n chromosomes. So that's what defines the denominator. Now, how does the EM algorithm work when you do not observe the missing the haplotype? So the first term represents the sum over individuals. Okay, then for each individual, you know the genotype data. And given that genotype, you know that there are certain possible diplotypes that are consistent with that genotype. So the second sum represents that possibility, all those possibilities. And then given all possible haplotype pairs that are consistent with the genotype, you can count how many times that haplotype appears in that diplotype. And that could be 0, 1, or 2, because each person has at most two haplotypes. And then you weight those counts according to the conditional probability of observing that pair of haplotypes given the genotype data. That's the standard EM algorithm. And of course, those probabilities depend on the haplotypes themselves, so this would be an iterated algorithm, and you have to specify these things under Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium because there are identifiability issues. And then once you know how to estimate haplotype frequencies, then you can construct simple tests or associations. For example, if you have a case control sample, you can estimate haplotype frequencies for cases and controls and compare them using some kind of chi-square test or something. But more recently, there's been more advances in the model-based approaches. So I'll try to show you, like, okay, some how to estimate, like, for example, parameters in the Cox proportional hazard model after accounting for such uncertainty in, for analysis of, say, cohort and nested case control study. And so the idea is that if I could observe a pair of haplotypes for a subject, then I would probably model the risk of the disease or the hazard given the pair of haplotypes in terms of Cox proportional hazard model, where it is the baseline hazard, and this is the relative risk function. And the, in the most general model, I will have the for each haplotype pair or diplotype, I will have a relative risk parameter associated with that pair of diplotype in reference to a common category. So there will be k minus 1, the relative risk parameters. But again, we are faced with these identifiability issues because certain diplotypes are never directly observable. So not only that we will not be able to estimate the frequencies of those parameters, we cannot also estimate the relative risk parameters associated with those categories unless we make further assumptions. So at this point, what is typically done is that we specify a mode of effect. That means the one common way to specify is called what is an additive effect. That means we assume that the relative risk associated with the combination of the haplotype R and S is given by the product of the relative risk associated with the individual haplotype. So in the log relative scale, this is an additive effect. But there are other models like the co-dominant model or recessive model. But the idea is that you bring down the number of parameters and you make things identifiable. And once you do that, so what we thought like, so the idea is that, okay, so we are interested in estimating the parameters in this model that the hazard given the diplotype, but what we could really observe is the genotype data. So what we do, like we derive an induced hazard function of the disease given the genotype data, and which you can obtain from the original hazard function, the expected value of the original hazard function given the genotype data. And since you are dealing with hazard, you'll have to always remember to condition on these events, because this is hazard is defined conditional on the fact that you have survived up to that time point. So that's the formula. And then you can, by simple algebra, you can show that this takes this form, which is a little, it's not anymore in the proportional hazard form anymore, because in the front you still have the baseline hazard, but the relative hazard takes a more general form here. It not only depends on the relative risk parameters, but it also depends on the haplotype frequency parameters as well as the baseline hazard. So as you see that the relative hazard function now depends on the time. But if you make a further assumption of rare disease, that means you can forget about this conditioning event, then you can show that this takes a more simpler form. It is actually a proportional hazard form where you have the baseline hazard, and here you are taking just the expected value of the original relative risk functions given the genotype data. And this is the kind of approach has been actually also taken by Prentice for handling this induced hazard function approach has been taken for handling measurement error in the Cox model. And so our estimation strategy is that, so if you so here notice that this is the hazard function we're going to deal with, but it does not only depend on the beta parameters which are estimated, we are interested in estimating, but it also depends on this nuisance parameter, the haplotype frequencies and the baseline hazard. So our estimation strategy is to first estimate these haplotype frequencies using the kind of EM algorithm we showed. And if you have a full cohort studies, you can use all the subjects to estimate the haplotype frequencies. That will be an unbiased estimator for the corresponding population parameter. But for nested case control, it's more complicated because this sampling is distorted, so you cannot use as a random sample. So it's probably a good idea to use just the controls to estimate the haplotype frequency and assume it's a rare disease. And then once we have estimated the haplotype frequency, we fix that parameter, and then we estimate the beta and the baseline hazard parameters in an iterated way, where we estimate the beta parameter, the relative risk parameters, using a kind of a weighted partial likelihood approach, and then the lambda naught parameter using a weighted Breslow type of estimator. And that algorithm performs fairly well. So the main observation here is that, like, for this kind of analysis, one has to be careful. One has to make some assumptions for identifiabilities, like Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium and mode of effects, things like that. And once you make these assumptions, then basically that you can make model-based inference in this for haplotype-based analysis using standard method for handling missing data or measurement error in covariate in regression problems. And then finally, I'll come to my third topic. And here I'll try to make some very general observation about analysis of genetic case control studies when you have missing data. And this is not related to a particular topic. It's a very general problem. And it's actually applicable also to like other areas of case control studies that doesn't have to be genetic. But it's particularly pertinent to genetics, I think. So I'll start by reviewing some known results for analyzing case control studies. So we want to make, if you have a binary outcome, what you are typically interested in is to make, analyze the data using logistic regression model. So the logistic regression model is a prospective model. That's the probability of the disease equal to 1 given Z. The logit of that is specified by the linear function. And these are the beta is the regression parameter, the odds ratio parameter. And that's what we are interested in estimating. And we have the intercept parameter in the model. And we have a covariate distribution hanging there. Now, in the case control design, the data is collected in opposite way. That is not collected in a prospective way. It's collected in the opposite way. That means we fix the number of cases and controls we're going to sample, and then we go back and collect their covariate history. So in principle, if you want to write down a likelihood, you'll have to first start with the take account of the design. And so if you start with that, so the design, the actual likelihood would be the probability of the Z out covariates given the disease status. And we can see that by standard Bayesian arguments, you can write down these in terms of the, where this H things is basically the likelihood corresponding to a prospective model, which depends on the intercept parameter and the regression parameter, and you have the covariate distribution, and the complexity arises in the denominator where you have the integral, and it involves both these and the covariate distribution. So it seems like a fairly formidable problem because Scott was saying that this is, it seems a very complex maximization problem because if you have a lot of risk factors, then this would be an infinite dimensional maximum likelihood problem, which is very difficult. But then there's this wonderful classic results, which shows that, in this paper, that the maximum likelihood estimate you'll get by maximizing this complex looking retrospective likelihood, the estimate for the beta, would be same as if you'd obtain by simply fitting a prospective logistic regression model to case control study, or you completely ignore the design and treat as if your disease was random. It was not fixed by design. So that's very nice. Yeah, 5 minutes. Okay. And then there are more recent results on dealing with missing data and measurement error and things like that. And these results show that, like, if you have developed a method for handling missing data in the context of prospective logistic regression analysis, it would be also valid to those methods would be also valid for analyzing case control data to handle missing values. And this has been shown in the context of the maximum likelihood analysis as also as estimating equation approaches. But one key thing to remember here is all these results assume that the distribution of the cofactors you are handling with, that you have left this unspecified, non-parametric. So do these results hold for genetic studies? Now, one thing we do in genetic studies is often make parametric assumption for analysis of genetic studies. For example, in the covariate space. For example, one common assumption is the Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium, which is basically specifying the genotype frequencies. For example, if you have a biallelic locus, there are three genotype categories. You are specifying those frequencies in terms of one parameter. A semi-parametric assumption is often made is the independence of gene and environment. Like the genetic and non-genetic factors are independently distributed in the underlying population. Now, when there is no missing data, the prospective analysis of retrospective data is always valid because the prospective analysis does give the retrospective maximum likelihood under the non-parametric model. So you are ignoring this parametric assumption, so it's still valid, but you may lose some efficiency. And for example, we have shown that in one paper that we assume gene and environment independence, you can do a much more efficient analysis of case control studies than the logistic regression. But the logistic regression analysis is still valid, consistent. But if you are missing data and you are using this, develop these prospective methods for handling missing data, assuming this parametric model, I'll argue that those methods may not be even valid or may not be consistent for analysis of case control studies. So what goes wrong? So here, suppose we have a model for, let's say, logistic regression model. Suppose Z is the complete set of covariates, if you could observe them, and this is the prospective score. And so what suppose you can observe is some subset of covariates or some part of it. So the corresponding score is given by the expected value of the original score given the observable data and the disease status. That's how we construct. And so if you have to show that this method would work for analysis of case control studies, what you have to show that these score equations are unbiased at the true parameter values under the case control design. And then that's the main step to show the consistency. Now, when you take the expectation of this kind of prospective scores under the case control design, so what you get is basically it's like an expectation of a conditional expectation, and this conditional expectation is the expectation evaluated here, assuming all the parametric models. But the outside conditional expectation is with respect to the case control design. So notice that this expectation is not with respect to the original underlying population, because by case control design, you're oversampling the cases, so the kind of basis the population is distorted. So this is like with respect to a biased population. Now what happens is that if you are considering the class of the covariate distribution F to be completely non-parametric, then the nice thing happens is that basically there is some results, like for example Prentice and Pike, or I think I like this the way they have stated here in this paper also, that it says that without changing this retrospective probabilities, one can choose the values of the intercept parameter and the covariate distribution so that the conditional expectation value would be the same, but you could basically match these two expectations. So you can think of like these two expectations are under the same probability law. And once you can do that, this becomes the expectation of a conditional expectation. That becomes a single expectation. And it looks like the expected value, it looks like it's like a prospective expected equation. So it's like a expectation under a prospective design of the prospective score. So that representation holds. And that's zero. Because of the it is a prospective score and it's a prospective expectation. Sorry, this is a misprint. This should be F. But the problem is that when you have the class of distribution function, you are considering parametric, that means more restricted than the more general non-parametric F, then you will never maybe able to match these two distribution, the original population and the biased population. For example, suppose you are making Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium assumption for the population. Even if it holds in the population, in the case control sample, it may not ever hold if the disease is associated with the gene. Or for example, you're assuming normality for the covariate distribution in the population, but in the case control sample, it will not hold because of the distortion. So if you're making parametric assumption, you may not be able to ever match these two expectations, and that kind of representation, which holds for the non-parametric F, doesn't hold anymore, and so the general unbiasedness property doesn't hold. So the key message here is that caution is needed for prospective analysis of case control data in presence of when you have both missing data and parametric distribution assumption. You need both, because if you have missing data, but it is you're treating everything non-parametrically, you're fine. And also, like if you don't have missing data, but you want to make parametric assumption, but if you do a prospective analysis, that means you are ignoring the parametric assumption, but it's still a valid analysis. But if you have both, then it is a problem. And having said that, I'll also try to say that the bias may be small in some like in the context of haplotype analysis, it has been shown that the bias is not maybe very large, unless there is a very large fraction of missing data or the actual regression effects are very strong. For example, if the under the null, it would be fine. Because if the under the null, the case control is like a representative sample of the population. And so those results will hold. But when you go away from the null, then things start falling apart. And also you need a fairly large amount of missing data to have large bias. Thank you.